Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of Carol Ange's interview with the non-fiction writer Kate Cahoon. Here, Kate talks with Carol about the workaholic Joseph Paxton's parental regrets, the pros and cons of British cooking, and holding the basket of domesticity while ideas float away like untethered balloons. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 42.
Now, I think what we need to do is to go back to your first book, to Joseph Paxton again. This couldn't be quite the same suspense-filled tale as Mr. Briggs has had, because it's a story of a whole life and not just, you know, a chase of a murderer. And perhaps because it's a biography rather than a work of narrative nonfiction. So I found it fascinating and dramatic as well, because Paxton was, the things that he did were just extraordinary, and also full of beautiful descriptions of gardens and glass houses and the Crystal Palace itself. Still, there is a difference between biography and a dramatised non-fiction. And I'd like you to talk just a bit about the different challenges of doing a biography and doing that, and how you managed to make a biography such a good read.
I'm not sure that I can answer that insofar as that was my first book and I just did it by the seat of my pants. I didn't really know what I was doing. I wrote what I would like to read, I suppose. I wrote about what I thought was interesting.
But of course, as you've said, you know, you can't invent anything, but you can shape things. You can tighten, you know, the pace up a little bit or let it spread out a little. That you can leave a lot of things out. That kind of shaping mechanism is that, or skill is the same, isn't it?
I'd love to say it is, but I wasn't in any way aware of that creative, self-consciously creative process with that book. I wrote it in incredible naivety. I just wrote. I had no idea what I was doing. I did, though, have an extraordinary editor with Paxton. Not that he had to change it a great deal, but who definitely helped me to shape it, you know, perhaps move a chapter ending, perhaps take out a paragraph here or there. It wasn't so much beefing anything up or taking much out, but I'm sure that that sense of pace, I'm sure that's what he was aware of. And you do hear a lot nowadays that kind of editing doesn't really exist anymore. I was really fortunate that for my first book I had a proper, serious, clever editor who sat down and went through every page with me and sent me back to my computer full of enthusiasm for making it a better thing. That process is a passive way of teaching. You know, nobody ever said, do this and it will turn out like that. They just said, how about you think about doing it like this? Or how about you notice that you've repeated the same word a few times? Or small things, really, but then you don't do it again. Somehow it's become part of your writing DNA.
I know, I was told by my first editor, she pointed out that I used the words, of course, on every page, possibly more than once.
Yeah.
And I'd never realised that.
Yes, I use now. So when I get to the end of my first draft, I do a word search and delete on almost every now, which can have very funny effects. But yeah, we need to know our ticks.
Yeah. Now, you've told us how you came across Joseph Paxton. You lived with him for many years. What made that possible for you?
He just was a man that, you know, he played the cards that life dealt him with such passion and vigour and energy and shrewdness. And yes, he made mistakes, as we all do, but I mean, he tore through life, as many of those great Victorians did. He was a polymath. He was an autodidact. He was truly remarkable in so many ways, and he got things done. And he did it all with real integrity, which I thought was, I still think, is really rare.
Also, you describe him, and very effectively, as a very charming person. He seems to have had great, what we might call nowadays, emotional intelligence. He seemed to understand people and handle people naturally, not manipulatively, very well, in a sympathetic kind of way. And so the friendship between him and the Duke of Devonshire, for example, the sixth Duke of Devonshire, is just extraordinary the way you describe it. So he's extremely charming, and where I was entirely charmed by him too. But I do wonder a bit about the dark side. The dark side of Joseph Paxton.
Yes, well, of course, you know, speaking as a historian, it's not in the record. So, and I don't get a sense that it's been expunged either. There are not obvious gaps either in the correspondence or in the Duke's diaries. And the Duke tells us a huge amount about Paxton because he was so much his admirer. He was his patron and his employer, but he was also his great admirer and wrote a diary every day. So, you know, we do find out a lot. Plus Sarah, Paxton's wife, who was a remarkable woman herself, wrote to him several times a day as he wrote to her. And so they had a very frank and lovely marriage. And there are two great sadnesses in his life. One is the loss of William, his littlest boy. He became ill and he died, but he wasn't there. And he wasn't there because he was busy being a terrier, rushing around, doing. And the second sort of tragedy in his life was that George, his only surviving son, he had many children, but only one other surviving son, was a failure and was probably a failure and a rebel and a reprobate and all those things because he didn't have a father's steadying hand. You know, that actually in George, Paxton took his eye off the ball. And I'm sure felt at the time that he shouldered a great burden of blame for that because he was too busy. And that's quite a big failure as a man to have failed your son when you've achieved so much. But it's an understandable human failure.
Now, unlike you, I'm a hopeless cook. I thought I was going to be bored by taste, but I wasn't at all. And I was fascinated, for example, by your account of how much worse the diet of the poor is in modern times than it was sort of in the very earliest times, because white bread was simply not available. So people had to eat bread made of this such rough grain that it wore their teeth to stumps, you wrote in Taste. But it was obviously good for their innards and kept their organs healthy. And on the other hand, it's just hilarious in Taste to see how we haven't changed, how the Brits have not changed. Well, we've always been bad at certain things like vegetables and so on. And altogether, I felt that your tone about British cooking was pretty modest. Can you talk a bit about what we are particularly bad at and why?
We can't make coffee. We've never been able to make coffee. And even all of the Starbucks and the whatever they're called on the high streets, we still can't make coffee. And very rarely do you come across some lovely small cafe and you order a coffee and you just think, oh wow, that's like sitting in Venice or that's like sitting in Paris. And boy, they know how to make their coffee. We can't do that. And, oh, you know, we're getting so much better at it. But I have spent an awful lot of my life eating rubbish salads, you know, really watery, ghastly, tasteless things with horrid salad cream on them from a bottle. And so the things that we've done badly are laughably funny, and probably we always will do them badly. But the things we do well, gosh, we really do work very well indeed and continue to do very well.
For example?
Oh, well, you know, I only wish we all ate more puddings, but, you know, we've always been great at puddings. We've always been great at anything to do with cream because we've got our fat cows eating our lovely grass, producing the most amazing milk and cream. So, we invented trifle, and then we sort of pretty much, you know, meringues came along for cream, didn't they? And anything to do with cream, we've always done very well. Puddings, I mean, I'm talking about boiled puddings, the kind of Christmas pudding, Sussex Pond pudding, roly-poly pudding, all of those wonderful things that, of course, people don't eat anymore because they're worried about their hearts. You know, we wouldn't be as worried about our hearts if we'd all took a lot more exercise and we turned our heating down. Then we could eat all this fantastically stodgy food, which tastes great and actually is quite skillful, much of it. We have amazing ingredients naturally, indigenously in this country. And actually the really worrying thing is that, you know, until the Industrial Revolution, your average, you know, middle class, well off, eating a good diet, Brit, ate something in the order of 200 or more different types of food a year. And it was many more, I think. I can't remember the exact amount. Whereas today, our diet is concentrated on less than 10 different foods, which can't be either good, can it, for kind of biodiversity or international agriculture or actually our bodies. We're starting to get a little bit of that kind of diversity back, but But I'm not sure we'll ever be any good at coffee, and I'm not sure we'll ever be any really, really good at salads.
Is there a connection for you between cooking and writing?
I don't know, but what I do know is that I take on the personalities sometimes of the people who I'm reading about. I mean, obviously I don't, you know, I don't become Alexis Soyer, nor do I become Elizabeth David, but I sort of inhabit them if they're engaging, as both those people were and as many other cooks before. And certainly when I was reading Elizabeth David, I did want to tie my hair up in a wonderful headscarf, and I wanted to smoke in the kitchen while making kind of Irfan cocotte with my bare hands. Good food writing is amazing, isn't it? And there are, you know, even now, writers that I read for their culinary writing, although I don't often use their recipes. So is there a connection between writing and food? Beyond that, words nourish us, don't they, in the same way as good food, for those of us who care about words. So I think there is a connection there, a sensory connection.
Another question about words in taste. One of the things I loved about it was all the word biographies that you gave us, kind of etymological chases, you know, various words that I'd never thought of in this connection or like that before. For example, you told us that pantry was originally just a storage place for bread.
Yes.
Which makes sense. Pan, bread.
Yeah.
Or one I loved, which was also to do with bread, was companionship. Yes. With bread.
The cornerstone of society, to break bread with somebody, you know, is companionship. That's what creates society. And, you know, all those other words. There are millions of them. I mean, food words are threaded through our language because without food, you don't survive, and language is the thing that pulls your society together and in many ways makes you human. You know, salary, of course, to do with salt, and many Romans were paid in salt. So for a man to be not worth his salt means a similar thing, a worthless thing, somebody who can't earn anything, you know, who's worthless. There are many of them out there. I mean, punch. I love that punch, was supposedly from Hindi, the five ingredients, panch being the five ingredients that went into a good Georgian punch. Hash, well, haché in French, to cut, so a hash is something which is cut small, and also hodgepodge comes from Spanish, hola podrida, which was a similar sort of a stew, the kind of a stew that Don Quixote would have eaten with Sancho Panza, or perhaps Sancho Panza would have made for him. Lots of different things all going into the pot with vegetables and pulses, and that came back to England in early Stuart times as an hola podrida, which became a hodgepodge.
All your books have been different. So there's a biography and a history of cooking and two historical stories. Will you change again? Would you contemplate writing a novel?
No, I never have. I mean, never say never. I did once begin a novel. I think I wrote two pages of description, atmosphere. My parents and my mother's parents before them live in a particular place very close to a hill on which there was a double hanging in 1670s. And it's one of my favourite places in the world, and a very dramatic ancient landscape. And so I thought perhaps I'd write a novel about this because I knew the geography so well. And I couldn't do it. I don't have yet, at any rate, that kind of an imagination. I'm nosy. You know, I draw from other people's letters and other people's diaries and from archives. I think I could be persuaded, I could persuade myself to novelise a story based on a massive amount of primary source material, because there's always that temptation, isn't there, to make a little bit up. So I could see that I could be tempted, but I can't really imagine ever being any good at it. And most particularly because dialogue, I think, is really hard. And if you write a novel, you sort of have to do dialogue, don't you?
Well, we'll wait and see.
Yeah, never say never. But
and just
not.
One other thing about, you know, you've always written in historical periods, as it were. Would you ever consider writing something more contemporary?
Yes. I wouldn't write anything to in the sort of murder strand. I certainly wouldn't write, for example, about Myra Hindley or Mary Bell. I wouldn't write about a really brutal crime where people who suffered as a result of it were still alive. I couldn't, I don't think. And I think there are problems as a historian with having records available. It begs the question, doesn't it, what is history? Is history the 1970s? 1980s? 2000? I mean, when does it become now and when was it then? When do you have enough perspective to be able to say something interesting about it, to add something to it? When is it historical enough to have an archive? When is it history enough no longer to touch in a painful way living lives? I did once, in a moment of utter madness, consider writing a biography of Julie Andrews, because I think she's so fantastic. I mean, I very, very quickly, almost as soon as it came into my head, I realised that I was completely mad, that there was no way on earth I could do it, that I was not equipped to do it, and that she doesn't even live in this country, even were I allowed to do it. I think people who write biographies of living folk are actually very brave. It's a different sort of a thing. And again, I would never say never, but it would have to be someone really special. And it would have to be someone whose life, to go back to what I said earlier, ended up being, for a reader, more than the sum of its parts. A life which allowed us to look at a wider context, a century, a period, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, or a group, the writers, these artists, whatever, these dancers. I think it would have to do that.
So you are the mother of two young sons, still at school. And how do you integrate your writing with your life as a mother?
When my oldest son was a baby and I was researching and writing Paxton, I felt that I actually did have the luxury of a continuity of thought. I was rarely interrupted in a violent and long-term way, if you know what I mean. You know, feeding, changing, playing, all those sorts of things, they don't take a huge amount of time, and he went to some childcare a few days a week and we had some help and my husband was amazing and took half the burden, and you know, those sorts of things. What I feel as they grow older and what I've had to learn to deal with is, if you liken ideas to sort of helium balloons with great long strings, ribbons hanging down, and the ideas are kind of lifting up out of your head all the time and randomly, sometimes in great clusters and sometimes just one. But you don't know when they're going to come, and you hardly even notice that they've popped up until you see them disappearing over the horizon. And I think I felt when they were younger it was easier to reach out and grab the strings and tether those ideas somehow to the back of a chair. It might have meant rushing upstairs to my office and quickly writing something, or writing something in a notebook or something like that. I find increasingly that I have to get used to the fact that I watch my helium balloon thoughts disappear over the rooftops endlessly. I even have stopped reaching out for them now. That used to hurt almost physically. Now I have learnt to sort of trust that somehow they're still lodged inside me and that they'll come back, and that if they don't, they'll be replaced by another idea. The most difficult thing to negotiate is the gear change. Seeing your watch and thinking, whatever time you have to go and pick them up, it's 3 o'clock, and being tempted to take it to the wire, you know, to go on writing, to start the new paragraph, to try to finish your chapter, until you really get to the point where you have to literally go control save, lock the door, out and into the car, running down the street, picking them up, and there has been no time to affect a mental and emotional step that you might have if you were on a bus or in a tube between work and home. You cram them together in order to try and buy 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And that's not always easy, because I think with that comes sometimes impatience and stress and heart beating and all those other things. And also, you know, if you push it to the wire, as I do all the time, the fridge is often empty. The kids come home and open it and say, what's for supper? And you kind of think, God, I knew I'd forgotten something. So there are things that you do very badly when you're trying to do too much, and you just muddle through. I think that's probably all I can say, except for that the process for each book seems to change in order to fit around the children. And I'm now at that point where I'm becoming acutely aware that there isn't that much time. You know, that won't be forever. It's been wonderful to be able to have a job where I've still been able to be a part of their lives, even though it's been a full-time job. I've been at home, you know. I wish I had more time, of course, to read more books, to read more newspapers, to read more magazines, to listen to the radio more, to have more of these kind of conversations, to open myself up to be inspired by other ideas. And I think just as you learn about your own creative process, perhaps a little bit as each book goes along, I have and am still learning to give myself a break, because I think it is very difficult to be creative when you're also holding the basket of domesticity.
Well, thank you. It was really, really fascinating. Thank you very much.
You're very brave. You know what they say, you know, put a microphone in front of a writer and you'll never get away.
That was Kate Cahoon in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Kate on the RLF website. Her surname is spelt C-O-L-Q-U-H-O-U-N. And that concludes episode 46, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 47, the poet Hilary Davis speaks with Julia Copus about the long poem's role in the literary landscape and discusses her own long poem, Imperium. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.